Welcome back to the Best Anchor Stocks podcast, and welcome to the first episode of 2025. I was lucky enough to be joined by my good friend, John Rotondi. John was a great guest, and I would consider this episode one of my all-time favorites. We talk about his upcoming role as a portfolio manager, what makes industrial and infrastructure companies appealing, and the current state of the stock market. Before jumping into the episode, let's hear about today's sponsors. All right, if you're serious about investing, you need to know about public.com. That's where you can invest in everything: stocks, options, bonds, crypto. They even offer some of the highest yields in the industry, like the bond account's 6% or higher yield that remains locked in even if the Fed cuts rates. What sets Public apart is how they give you the tools you need to make informed investment decisions. Their built-in AI tool called Alpha doesn't just tell you if an asset is moving. It tells you why the asset is moving, so you can actually understand what's driving your portfolio's performance. Public is a FINRA-registered, SIPC-insured, US-based company with a customer support team that actually cares. Bottom line, your investments deserve a platform that takes them as seriously as you do. Fund your account in 5 minutes or less at public.com/bestanchor and get up to $10,000 when you transfer your old portfolio. That's public.com/bestanchor. Paid for by Public Investing. Full disclosures in podcast description. Last but not least, a bit of self-promotion. At bestanchorstocks.com, my investment research service, you'll find recurring articles about high-quality companies. The paid subscription gives you access to all past and future content, my portfolio and transactions, and much more. Find it at bestanchorstocks.com. So the first episode of 2025 is going to be with my good friend, John Rotondi. I'd say John, besides a great investor, is also a great person, which I think it's a combination that's hard to find in financial markets. But John definitely has the best of both worlds. So thank you very much, John, for coming. I know we've been talking about this episode for a long time, and we have finally made it happen.
Yeah, I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for those kind words. I feel the exact same way about you, which is why, you know, I have a network with you, and I enjoy talking with you so much. So thanks for having me on the show.
I imagine some of the listeners will already know you, but for those who don't, maybe it would be great if you give a bit of context of your investment career. I know that you've recently changed paths with, which we'll talk about later, but maybe a bit of context around how you started investing, what places have you been in, and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so I'm currently a portfolio manager at Isla Mirada Investment Management. But if we go back, and I'm 44, just turned 44. If we go back to when I was 18, I was a freshman in college, and I found out that my parents got into some financial trouble, and I didn't know what a stock was. I didn't know what a bond was. Had no idea, but I went to the library at my university and I started reading every book I could find. I eventually read, one of the early books I read was One Up on Wall Street by Peter Lynch. And the book changed my life. It put me on the trajectory that I'm still on today. It's one of only, maybe two books I've ever read that really set off a light bulb in my head.
I would say that as an introductory book, that's probably one of the best books that have ever been written.
I would agree. And it's I still get emotional thinking about that book, because the light bulb that it put off in my head was twofold. One was, this is something that I enjoy and that I think I want to do for the rest of my life. That was one epiphany. The other was, I understand this. Like, he doesn't go into a lot of the math of investing, but he talks about some basic ratios, debt to equity and price to earnings and the PEG ratio, and all of the math made sense to me. And so the two epiphanies were, I can do this. I have the mental capacity and the interest to do it. And I really enjoy doing it. And so this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And so I was a freshman, I don't know if I was 18 or 19 at the time, but, and I haven't stopped reading about businesses and markets and investing since then. I eventually went on to get an MBA, but I'm self-taught as an investor largely. And I'll say why largely in a second. But, I'm still teaching myself. I'm still learning from others. I'm still trying to dissect why other great investors that I admire invested in a certain security. And I try to sort of, you know, back my way into it. I read their thinking and philosophy behind investing. And I've developed my own philosophy and process and structure. But I learn from, you know, giants that came before me. But I would say I'm largely self-taught. I say largely because I got an MBA, and the accounting classes definitely helped with investing, in my opinion. Accounting and financial statement analysis, those classes, I'm putting those into one category. And then I did take what was called an experiential learning class, very hands-on class. It's called Birken Road Reports. It still exists today. The professor is a dear friend and mentor of mine, Peter Raschuti. The class is you break up into groups, and each group covers a publicly traded company for a semester. And over that semester, you meet with the management team. You actually travel to meet with the management team, and you research virtually every aspect of the business, and you write what looks like a sell-side report, what looks like a sell-side initiation report. And so it teaches you how to be a sell-side analyst in a lot of ways. It cannot teach you anything, but it's a great introductory class in how to be a sell-side analyst. So that class has definitely helped in my education. And then the other reason I say I'm not fully self-taught is because when I got to the Motley Fool, I was part of their analyst development program. I think now it's called investor development program, but it was called analyst development program while I was there. And it was a year-long intensive course, basically like a second MBA, covered all of the classes that we took in MBA, like accounting and financial statement analysis and valuation and more. But then it also covered additional classes like how to achieve mastery. And it actually, the class studied masters, whether Olympic champions or Yo-Yo Ma as a cellist or chess grandmasters, and it studied what it took them to achieve mastery. We took classes on decision fatigue and how to minimize it. And there's just a variety of other classes that kind of went above and beyond an MBA, largely self-taught. And, you know, I went to New York right after I got my MBA in December of 2010 and started working for a sell-side equity research firm in institutional equity sales. I was an awful salesman. Because at least stock salesman, research salesman, because to make a lot of money to do that, you have to get your clients to trade often across your desk. It's called soft dollar. And so, you know, you call them on the phone and you say, you know, we think you should get out of this stock and into this stock. I'm not good at that. I'm much more long-term focused and patient at, you know, just as you are, Leandro. So I couldn't make a living in institutional equity sales, because, you know, my conversations, I'd have a 30-minute conversation with my clients about some company's moat. And I'm loving it. I'm loving every minute of it, but I'm not getting them to buy a stock or sell a stock across our desk. I'm just learning from them. But two things I want to call out about institutional equity sales, which I think is an incredible springboard for my career and anybody's career in the investing world, is one is you build this great network. You know, I was calling on mutual funds and hedge fund managers all day long. You know, in some cases, I was making 20 or 30 calls a day. And excuse me, I wasn't only calling with them, but I was visiting them and then traveling with them, literally taking them on non-deal roadshows, taking management teams of the companies that the analysts followed on non-deal roadshows to meet with my clients. And so, you know, I was spent a lot of time with them. And that's how I started to build the network. But the other thing is, as a sell-side analyst, if you're an equity analyst, you know, you cover 15 or 20 companies in a specific industry or sector, and you become an expert on that industry or sector, which is great, and it's necessary. But in institutional equity sales, I had to know something about 300 companies. So because if one of my clients called and said, hey, what do you think about this company or this stock? I had to be able to speak intelligently about that company across, you know, a dozen different industries and sectors, or you know, eight to a dozen different. And so it was a great way to learn about a lot of businesses very quickly and to build a network. And then So we made it over to The Motley Fool. I was there for almost 9 years. I was a senior analyst. I was a portfolio lead. So I led a portfolio. And I think most importantly is I was the head of investor training and development. And so I trained all the new analysts. I acted as a resource to the whole investment team, not just new analysts. And I brought in outside experts to teach like continuing education classes to the team. So, you know, practitioners, real portfolio managers in real life. And then also academics like Oswald the Moderon and Michael Mobison. And, you know, I eventually started a podcast and on investing process and philosophy, studying some of the best investors in the world and the investors that I admire the most. And that podcast got me to help me get the job that I have today as a portfolio manager.
And you said earlier when you were talking about Peter Lynch's book, you said something interesting. You said that you had the mental capacity to do it, right? Besides liking what analyzing businesses and stuff. How did you realize that you had the mental capacity?
You know, just every concept I think that he talked about in the book, whether it was a more qualitative concept like actually understanding the businesses you're investing in, going out and trying the products, standing in line at Starbucks, whatever it may be, to the more financial, fundamental, in some cases, even technical concepts, not technical like trading, but there's more data involved. And so, you know, he shared visuals in the books on earnings growth relative to the PE ratio, basically a peg in visual, and the idea that you want to ideally, all else equal, buy when the PE is less than the expected growth rate in earnings. So a peg less than one. And I know there's problems with the peg and it breaks when growth is not very fast and stuff like that. But just seeing that vision, I understood it. Like I understood what a PE was. And I think he helped explain it. Stock price divided by earnings, it's really, if the PE is 10, what is that? Well, it's if the company's earnings don't grow, right? It means it would take you 10 years to break even on your investment. That's what a PE of 10 is. You're buying 10 years of earnings. And so if earnings per share is $1, stock price is 10, you have a PE of 10. If earnings are stable state, that means it's earning $1 this year, $1 next year, $1 the year after that for 10 years. Well, you pay $10 up front, 1111 out 10 years. It means it'll take you 10 years to break even. That was like I get that, right? Compared to paying a PE of 50. Now, I know there's nuance. I get it. But at this very early stage in my career, I was like, why would I want to take 50 years to break even when I could take 10 years to break even? Once again, I understand there's nuance and different companies have different warranted and justified PE ratios today. But back then, that was just like such a concept for me to grasp, valuation and how it relates to earnings. And what you're really buying is earnings. Legally, what we're buying is earnings per share. The share owners like ourselves, we have residual claim on a company's earnings. The first claim is creditors. Interest on debt is paid first. Always and forever. You go down the income statement. And then after that, you pay taxes in the form of government. You pay the government in the form of taxes. And it's only after the company has paid all of its expenses, and that includes research and development, sales and marketing, cost of goods sold, down that income statement. Now, research and development could be seen as an expense. I mean, as an investment, I understand that. Some of sales and marketing could be seen as a long-term investment. I understand that. But currently, it's on the income statement as an expense. It's expense up front. So you have to pay all of that. Then you have to pay any interest on your debt legally. Then you have to pay the government and taxes legally. And then after all of that, if there's anything else left over, that goes to us in the form of net income per share, earnings per share. So I understood from reading Lynch what I'm buying legally. I understood why stocks go up over time, because earnings tend to go up over time, at least at good companies. And then I understood the PE in relation to earnings and why all else equal, a lower PE is better than a higher PE. And those were just like lightning bolts going off in my head.
So let's dig a bit deeper into your
current position? So you're going to be you already are a portfolio manager. I think you have yet to launch the fund, right? At Isla Morada. I don't know if you want to talk about, is it going to be called Isla Morada or you're changing the
name? Yeah, definitely. So we're still Isla Morada. We are in the process of changing the name to Bastion Fiduciary, you know, and the reason it's called Isla Morada is because it was founded in Isla Morada, Florida, which is in the Florida Keys. And both the founder and our other portfolio manager that is still with us, both of them were living in Isla Morada. Our founder still lives in Isla Morada. All of our early clients were from Isla Morada or surrounding areas. You know, we wanted, Kale, our founder, wanted to associate it with where it was founded. But now we have clients spread out, you know, over a dozen states. Our team is now distributed over 7 states. So we're going to change the name so that it's not branded just Florida. And then, you know, a bastion is like a star-shaped military fortress, basically, sometimes surrounded by a moat. You can Google, there's some beautiful images of bastions if you just, you know, Google it. And so, you know, that speaks to the fortress, the economic castle. You know, we're trying to invest in really high quality businesses. The economic castle can be thought of as that bastion, that fortress. That's the economic engine, the business model. That's the economic castle. And then, you know, often they're protected by moats. That's protecting that economic engine or that business castle. But then it also speaks to maybe 2 other things. A bastion, we're going to sort of like try our best to protect and shield our clients from some of the noise out there and some of the, you know, quick trading momentum mentality. Some of that silliness that is out there.
How do you plan to do that?
Education. You know, we're trying to speak with and communicate with our clients as often as we can. And we have lots of avenues to do that. So one is the portfolio manager who send out their letters to investors, quarterly or semi-annually letters to investors. That's sort of the common way a lot of portfolio managers communicate with their investors. And we're going to do that as well. But we're also going to launch a podcast where we talk about these concepts and educate. That's the second avenue. Each of the portfolio managers, myself, Kale, and Loretta, we're each going to have our own newsletters under the, you know, Isla Morada, eventually Bastion umbrella. But each newsletter under that umbrella is going to have our own brand. And so mine's going to be called J. Rose Notes. And so we're each going to have our own branded newsletters. That's a third avenue. So regular investment letters, the podcast, our own branded newsletters under the company umbrella. And then the fourth and my favorite, there's five, I'll get to the fifth in a second. But the fourth and my favorite is, you know, we have private chat rooms for our investors, for our clients. And so if they want to ask us a question and pose it to all of our investors, make it public behind a paywall, just to our investors, but make it public to all of the investors in my strategy, for example, they can do so. You know, John, why did you invest in XYZ company? And I can answer it in these chat rooms. Or John, XYZ stock is down 20 or 30 or 40%. What do you think is happening? You know, any of those types of questions they can pose on the board. And, you know, we love these chat rooms. We love speaking with our clients in these chat rooms. And then the fifth way that we communicate is just privately, one-on-one, through email, or they can call us, so we'll call them. So 5 different ways that we're going to be regularly and fully transparently communicating with our investors. And you know, it'll be a two-way street. We'll be learning some stuff from them. They'll be learning from us. But that's how we try to create that alignment in philosophy and process. There's a feeling of togetherness and alignment.
So I've always thought that education is probably super important, right, for any fund manager. I haven't managed outside capital, but when you see fund managers such as Terry Smith, for example, and how he educates his LPs to invest over the long term, that's evidently an advantage, because when tough times come, you probably get net inflows, right? At the moment you want them the most, and you don't suffer redemptions at the time you don't want them. But at the same time, all of that seems like a lot of work. So are you planning on doing all of this alone, or are you planning on hiring someone in the future?
So it is a lot of work. And I have two answers to that. So one is Kale, our founder, has taken almost all administrative responsibilities off of my plate. And this was discussed, you know, during a very long interview process. And Kale and I got to know each other over 6 or 7 months. And we talked about how this could work. And, you know, Kale wants the portfolio managers focused almost 100% on research, researching businesses, managing the portfolios, and communicating with our clients. Anything, you know, back office, middle office, you know, getting paperwork signed, anything involved in that, we have a team for that. We have a chief operating officer. We have, you know, portfolio specialists that deal with these type of administrative duties. So, you know, I couldn't even tell you an administrative thing that I've had to deal with. Kale has cleared my plate, cleared my time and my schedule to focus on research, thinking, writing, and communicating with clients. As far as am I going to hire, so we have that group hired. We have a solid team. And I mean, like really solid. Our chief operating officer has been a chief operating officer at other RIAs. He was also special operations pilot officer, the war on terror over the last 20 years in Afghanistan and Iraq. Being an officer in the military, you learn organizational structure, right? And process and how to get things done in an orderly way and on time and on budget. And he's just an expert at that. Kale also has a military background, our founder and CEO. He's Coast Guard Academy grad. We have another person that works with us that's a Coast Guard Academy grad. So there's just a lot of structure, layers of structure, not bureaucracy because we're a small team and we can move quickly when we want to, but just structure to make sure every box is checked. So that team is in place. As far as whether I'm going to hire an analyst at some point, I think we'll hire an analyst, probably someone that we share across the portfolio, the three portfolio managers, maybe within the next year. How I use an analyst, though, you know, I'm going to have to give some real thought to. My portfolio is going to have 20 to 40 stocks. You know, I like to think in wide ranges, give myself a lot of flexibility. But let's say 30. Right? Let's middle of the road, 30 stocks. I'm not going to pawn off maintenance coverage of my portfolio to an analyst. Not yet. You know, maybe not. You know, the old saying, you know, have one basket of eggs and watch that basket, you know, like a hawk. Like a mama hawk. I'm not going to pawn off maintenance coverage of companies. So when it comes to earnings, I'm listening to those calls. I'm reading those transcripts. I'm writing every earnings update, not AI, not an analyst. I'm writing these. I'm posting these on our boards to our members. Now, where I do think I could use an analyst, and I'm excited to use an analyst, is pitching me new ideas. I'm very open to have an analyst pitching me ideas. One, because a lot of my time is spent on maintenance coverage, and I could use help on new idea gen. But also because I think that pitching stocks and securities is an art, and I would love to help a younger analyst, you know, with that craft of a good pitch, a good elevator pitch, a good one or two page write up. I would love an analyst to help to do that. I would love an analyst to take on some sort of data analytics projects, you know. Get into the raw S&P 500 data or S&P 1500 data going back 30 years and, you know, pull out these different things I'm looking for, create great visuals around it, stuff like that. So I could find really good projects for analysts to work on. And then I would want that analyst also to get up to speed on all 30 companies in my portfolio so that we can have great conversations about those companies so that he or she can challenge me on those companies. or get me to look at something from a different lens. I want them to know every company in the portfolio up and down, right, left, solid. I just don't think I'm going to ask them to take on any earnings coverage responsibility.
Mm-hmm. So let's dig deeper into the portfolio per se. So I have two questions here. First, what is it going to focus on? I know it's going to be, let's say, capped in some particular sectors, which are pretty broad. So maybe you can explain that. And secondly, what are you going to try to achieve with it? Are you trying to beat the market? Are you trying to deliver market-like returns with less risk?
Awesome. So I am putting together like a 7,000 or 8,000 word Q&A on the portfolio, on the strategy. And it's being edited right now by the team and by compliance and stuff like that. And it's basically every question that I would ask if I was going to invest my money with someone else. And so I'm going to read a brief summary of, because one of the questions is, you know, can you please give us a quick overview of the Island Murata industrial and infrastructure portfolio you'll be launching? So here's what I wrote for the brief overview. The IIM industrial and infrastructure strategy is a domestic, long-term focused, low turnover, roughly 30 stock portfolio that aims to invest in high quality industrial, infrastructure, and housing related businesses at attractive valuations. Importantly, the businesses should be run by leaders that think and act like owners and that are economically aligned with outside shareholders. The vast majority of holdings will already have achieved scale, have healthy balance sheets, have high and or rising returns on invested capital, stable or growing free cash flows, high terminal values, and I have to think they have long runways of per share earnings growth. The rate of growth is less important than the duration of per share growth, as long as the valuations are reasonable relative to the rates of growth. We believe these businesses will have high barriers to entry, wide and sustainable moats, and several will operate in oligopolies or duopolies with high and stable market share, pricing power, and limited competition. Others will have leading market shares in highly fragmented industries, providing opportunities for long runways of growth through both market share gains, organic growth, and consolidation, inorganic growth. The businesses will offer strong value propositions and solve big, important problems. We're looking to invest in companies that do hard things and do those hard things well. We've got to believe these businesses are resilient and adaptable with survivorship genes and an almost maniacal focus on maximizing long-term business value per share. So that's a description of what we'll be looking to invest in. You can ask me any question you want off of that. As far as what am I trying to achieve? I don't love the idea of benchmarks because they encourage short-term thinking in a way. Because, you know, the S&P 500 is up XYZ quarter to date, and then, you know, month to date, and then year to date. And so some investors expect you to provide your performance month to date and quarter to date and year to date, because these numbers are you know, sprinkled all over social media. You can find these numbers anywhere in the newspaper and on social media. So I don't love the idea of a benchmark. However, the S&P 500 has been an unstoppable rebel force. It's a great asset class. It's a great asset class. I hesitated for a second because there's some concentration, but overall, it's a great asset class. And you can invest in the S&P 500 at a very, very, very low fee. And over time, depending on how far you go back, the S&P has delivered 10% annualized. More recently, maybe even 11% annualized. So it's a great asset class at a very low fee. And I'm thinking that if I can't outperform that over a five-year period, I wish I could say 10. I wish I could say 7 to 10 years, but I know 7 to 10 is a lot to ask of people. No matter how well I educate them, and no matter how aligned I hope they are with a long-term perspective, I know 7 to 10 is a long time to ask of people. So I'm at 5 years. And so if I had not outperformed over a 5-year period on a net basis, then, you know, I think investors should consider firing.
It's interesting that you say 5 years, right? Because we've talked about how you want to educate like your investor base so that at the end of the day, they are long-term oriented like you. But one topic that fascinates me is the incentive structure in the industry, right? I mean, a lot of people say that it's almost impossible to beat the S&P 500, something I agree with, by the way. I think it's super tough. But at the same time, when you look at many professional managers, I think we've all heard it goes something like only X percent of professional managers outperform the index over, let's say, a 10-year period. I also think that many professional managers have certain limitations, one being that they don't have permanent, probably the main one, that they don't have permanent capital, right? So most of them end up optimizing their portfolio to try to outperform every single year, because at the end of the day, they're trying to maximize assets under management. And unfortunately, that's how you can maximize those assets under management. Unless you have a super strong track record of 10, 20 years beating the market, then you have more, let's say, leeway to focus on the long term. So do you think that your investor base, you're going to be able to educate them to look 5 years out, or do you think it's going to be challenging?
I think it's going to be challenging. So, but I'm basically getting investors, and I have investors, you know, I'm taking clients. I'm basically getting investors from two sources right now. One, our current firm clients. They're invested in our other strategies, and they have decided to invest some in my new strategy. Those investors, many of them, have been investing with Kale since 2008, or with, you know, our other portfolio manager, Loretta, since 2013 or 14. And so they're educated. You know, I just got back from our investor meeting in Florida, and, you know, speaking with almost 40, they get it. You know, Kale has been doing that education. There's that alignment already. So some of them, yeah, they get it. Other investors are coming to me because they have followed my work when I was at the Motley Fool, or my podcast, my old podcast, The J-Row Show, or some of the things that I share on X. And they have reached out to me that way. Hopefully, Leandro, they understand that I'm a very long-term thinker, based on some of the things that I've published, some of the things that I've talked about publicly. But I still think it's going to be a challenge, because emotions get in the way. And, you know, humans are emotional beings, and education is one thing, but when times get tough, when stocks start falling, when markets start crashing, question things. Mm-hmm. And so I imagine there's going to be some tough conversations at certain times, for sure. But I'm really focused on being very intentional and deliberate about only communicating with my clients using language that fosters a long-term outlook, whether it's on podcasts, in my letters, on my newsletter, in, you know, my blogs, whatever it is, over the phone, really only communicating with them in language that encourages and fosters and nourishes a long-term patient outlook on things. And I hope that helps over time.
And let's talk about physical assets, right? You said the portfolio is going to be focused in industrial and infrastructure and real estate. So why do you think, I imagine if you took the job, is because you think there's opportunity in those sectors. Where do you think the opportunity lies in physical assets? What would you say they are a good investment, so especially in the era that we live, right? That mostly everything is about intangibles, and indices to a great extent are dominated by businesses that rely on intangibles. So where do you think the opportunity in physical assets lies?
So to be clear, I love, great question, but to be clear, I was not hired to run an industrial infrastructure portfolio. I was hired to launch any portfolio that I think would be best for my clients over the long term.
This okay, is, so even better then, it was an active decision.
This was an active decision by me. Yeah, that's the first thing I'll say. The second thing I'll say is the title of infrastructure and industrial portfolio, I think gives off certain connotations of it's going to be a very, very narrow pool to fish in. That's not the case. So, you know, if we just think about industrials and infrastructure, AI falls under infrastructure, especially this infrastructure layer build out. You know, if you think about Goldman Sachs has talked about this, lots of smart people have talked about this, but if you think about cloud computing, stepping back from AI for a second, but if you think about cloud computing, there's the infrastructure layer, IaaS, infrastructure as a service, there's the platform layer, PaaS, and then there's the software layer, S. Some analysts think there's going to be a similar build out of AI, and we're currently in that infrastructure layer, which includes, let's talk about it. If you just think about an AI data center, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is NVIDIA, GPUs. Well, that obviously an infrastructure investment that I could potentially make. So semiconductors, that falls clearly into infrastructure, clearly. But then you think about the rest of the data center. Well, you have the engineering construction companies that actually build the box, right? You have the servers and the server racks that these GPUs are actually put into. So the server company, you have the coolant companies, HVAC companies, but also the liquid cooling companies, because these things run so hot. You have the networking gear, the switches and routers, these days mostly switches that don't only connect server to server within a data center, but connect data center to data center. So networking, this computing power. So you have networking. It's a whole nother aspect is networking gear. You have all the tiny little sensors and electrical connectors and components that need to be used to build out these data centers. So you have sensor companies, connectors, electrical components, wiring, both copper and fiber optic. You have software monitoring that is used to monitor these servers and these data centers. And the list goes, you actually have the hyperscalers that are building out these data centers, have the third-party REITs, the real estate investment trusts that operate these data centers in co-located locations on behalf of not only hyperscalers, but other tech and telecom companies. So just in data centers, there's well over a dozen ways to invest in that thing. So, and semiconductor, right? You know, industrial is everything from transportation to not only trucks, but railroads, to logistics companies, to pool companies, you know, any kind of industrial automation, factory automation.
I have always thought that industrial companies tend to get disregarded as dinosaurs, when in fact, a lot of industrial companies, I think a lot of people would be surprised to how much high-end tech they apply and they develop.
Absolutely. I actually call them industrial technology companies. 100%. The ones, at least the ones that I'm looking at. You know, large equipment movers, tractors, earth movers. I know industries that you follow. That's all, you know, industrial technology. I mean, you've talked about the technology that goes into a Deere product. I mean, it's incredible. And then housing related, you know, it's not just home builders and land developers, but it's everything used to build a home or service a home. So, you know, siding companies, brick companies, roofing companies, insulation companies, decking companies, flooring companies, coatings and paint companies. I mentioned the home builders. There's third-party installers, companies that just install insulation, for example.
You have all the distributors that basically just...
The building materials and supply companies and distributors. Concrete, you know, it goes on and on. And then services, you know, plumbing, pest control, home insurance, home mortgages. And then I'll just mention one more grouping, alternative asset managers, you know, because they're heavily invested in industrials and infrastructure companies, both through equity, taking ownership stakes, and through private credit. You know, it's, you know, I could think so far outside the box of what falls into an industrial and infrastructure company. It's not even funny. I was on a podcast. I was on Chit Chat Stocks last week, I think it published. And I was talking to Ryan, the host, before we went on. And he was like, man, it's a shame you can't invest in like a company like Visa. And I was like, of course I can invest in Visa. Visa's an infrastructure company. Visa's got 10 million route miles of telecommunications infrastructure across the globe to make its processing, its payment network work in the blink of an eye, faster than that, you know. And so 10 million route miles of telecom infrastructure, that's an infrastructure company. You know, I mentioned Amazon in that.
That Visa example reminds me of when the quant firms were emerging, that they were building fiber optic cables from New York to Chicago just to be able to take advantage of the...
To get to the exchange as they can.
Yeah, to take advantage of the discrepancies as fast as possible.
In a microsecond. Yeah, exactly. You know, Amazon is an infrastructure company, in my opinion, not only because of AWS, you know, the data centers that they're building, which we should talk about that, the CapEx too, in a second, but e-commerce is a logistics nightmare. It's a logistics nightmare. I mean, they're an infrastructure logistics company, and then they're getting into pharmacy, online pharmacy logistics. That's a whole nother game because you need refrigerated. Some of these drugs need to be refrigerated. And so a company like Amazon, you mentioned fiber optics, let's bring up Alphabet. Obviously Alphabet with Google Cloud, that's a data center once again. What about what they're doing with quantum computers? These things are massive, massive, massive infrastructures. And then what they're doing with fiber. So the least of my concerns is how narrow is that my universe is too narrow. I have not come across one company, maybe one. I can't think of it, maybe one there where I wanted to invest or put it in my universe, but I said no, it doesn't fit because it's not clearly infrastructure, industrial, or housing related. I haven't come across one that I can't find a way to fit. But to your question, this is a very long answer. You asked, you know, what do I find attractive about hard assets? So industrials, as a whole, this includes the housing related and the infrastructure, it's an incredibly attractive asset class to me. Because first of all, I believe that some of the widest moats and some of the highest barriers to entry come from things that are really hard to do, that take a lot of capital and years to build out. New entrants can't compete with that. They don't have the capital. They don't have the time. So, you know, Taiwan Semiconductor spends $20 billion building one state-of-the-art semiconductor foundry facility. Between permitting and building, it'll take 4 years, 5 years for the Arizona thing to get off the ground. And that's with a lot of things being, you know, tried to be sped up because of this, you know, national security reasons and everything, and the you know, Infrastructure Reduction Act and the Inflation Act and the CHIPS Act, trying to direct money towards, you know, reshoring and onshoring and all this stuff. We're trying to speed this up, but you know, to build a state-of-the-art semiconductor foundry, which Taiwan Semi, as you know, has 95% market share at the leading end of AI chips, maybe more. They have 60% market share of all third-party outsourced semiconductors, and they have 95% market share, maybe more of AI semiconductors. That's $20 billion to build one in 4 years. Who's competing with that? Nobody is the answer. Nobody.
I mean, it reminds me of the Warren Buffett question. If I give you $1 billion, could you replicate this? Well, for TSMC, it would be a bit more than $1 billion.
Exactly. And so then people say, well, heavy capital-intensive companies, hard asset companies, fixed tangible companies don't generate high returns. Well, Taiwan Semi does. You know, it's 30-35% returns on equity. You know, returns on invested capital, 20% and higher, consistently. You know, the same thing for ASML, the same thing for all the companies that I'm looking at. And so you have these companies that are extremely high quality. They're doing something no one else is doing in some cases, not all cases. And the fact that it costs so much capital and takes so much time, it's almost an insurmountable barrier to entry and a moat. To build a new nuclear facility, you know, we haven't built a new one in the U.S. in a long time. Depending on the type that you build, Leandro, it takes 10 years. 10 years to build a nuclear facility. 10 years. If you're a utility right now and you want a new, right now, currently, you want a new large gas-fired turbine, if you put your name on the list today, you'll get it in 2029. 4 years, okay, to build transmission lines in the U.S., 2 years to permit, 2 years to build, minimum. 4 years. Like, these companies are doing hard things and doing them really, really well. And there's just not a lot of competition.
I'm gonna go there with the other side of the equation,
yeah,
right?
Okay.
Let's say that supply in hard asset industries takes quite a while to come online, right? I mean, TSMC doesn't build a factory in 6 months, but demand can move much faster. So then these industries, despite generating good returns and being secular over the long term, they tend to be quite cyclical, especially in the case of semiconductors. What's your view on this cyclicality, or are you going to try to time the cyclicality? Are you afraid of it, or you just don't care?
I'm definitely not afraid of it. Quite the contrary. I think that because you mentioned two things. You mentioned supply-demand dynamics makes them cyclical in the short term or over shorter periods of time. But you also used the word secular because the long-term drivers are there. Secular demand is there. So that creates opportunity in my mind. If there's long-term secular demand, then the cyclicality just creates short-term opportunities to get cheaper prices.
I remember I wanted to say this at the start of our conversation, but you interviewed Jerome Dodson, founder of Parnassus Investments, yeah. And he wrote something he told you something that it's actually, I was already pivoting to those kinds of investments, but it actually resonated a lot with me, which is what you are talking about now, which is that if you look for cyclical but secular companies or industries, then there will be a time where probably no one wants to touch it, even with a 10-foot pole, and everyone starts to forget about the long term.
Absolutely. And so the question I asked him in that interview was, what's the common characteristic of your biggest winners over time? And he said they were companies being powered by long-term tailwinds operating in cyclical industries, like semiconductors, mm-hmm. for example, because you get that opportunity. It goes back to the Buffett quote. You know, I think the quote is something on the order of prefer a lumpy 15% to a smooth 12%. I think that's almost a direct quote. We, talking about him and Charlie, we would prefer when Charlie was with us, a lumpy 15% to a smooth 12%. It's the same thing with investing in my opinion, my strategy. One of the things that I talk about in this Q&A that I mentioned that I'm going to put out at some point is I talk about, you know the ride you're getting on. This could be a bumpy ride in the short term. And so if you're an investor that, you know, gets uncomfortable with volatility in stock prices, I mean, and, you know, looking at your portfolio, if you're an investor that gets uncomfortable by that, then this is not the strategy for you. But yeah, I think that presents an opportunity to buy long duration growth, secular growth, when it's cheap, when it's cyclically cheap. You ask if I'm scared of it. No, I'm not scared of it. Am I going to time it? I'm not actively going to try to time it. But sometimes I think, I know timing is very hard and predicting the future is impossible, but I think sometimes you can.
Maybe a better question would have been, how do you view opportunity?
Yeah, I think sometimes you can see when an industry is cyclically depressed. I mean, like 2 years ago, I was tweeting a lot about how home builders at the time were trading at 4 to 6 times earnings and less than book value and less than the liquidation value of the assets on their balance sheet. And so even if earnings were high and the PE was misleading, think about how far earnings would have to fall for a PE of 4 to make sense. And so sometimes you can, I think, get a good sense of where you are in the cycle. I'll give you another reason, which is very relevant to today, which goes back to your question, why industrials? I think right now is a great time to invest in industrials. The ISM PMI has been in negative territory for 24 of the last 25 months. This is the longest stretch of negative in history. There have been deeper stretches where the index level, the PMI, fell further below 50. Right now, it's below 50, but in like the 47, 48, 49 range. So this is a shallower industrial recession, but the longest in history.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read the companies, you read the earnings calls of the companies that I'm following in my universe, which is about 100 stocks, 80 to 100 stocks is my universe, I would say right now.
Okay.
Almost all of them are saying they're seeing signs of a bottoming out. Because there is an industrial recession going on in the U.S. It's not a deep one, but it's the longest in history. And almost all of them are saying they're seeing signs of it bottoming out. Or we expect things to come off a bottom slowly throughout 2025.
Mm-hmm.
And so it won't be a really... They're not expecting a really quick inflection up, but a slow crawl out of the hole. So that's another reason why heavy industries, they've been in a recession.
Sorry to take you away from the episode, but let's hear about today's sponsors. All right, if you're serious about investing, you need to know about public.com. That's where you can invest in everything, stocks, options, bonds, crypto. You can even earn some of the highest yields in the industry, like the 6% or higher yield you can lock in with a bond account. Public is a FINRA-registered SIPC-insured platform that takes your investment as seriously as you do. Fund your account in 5 minutes or less at public.com/bestanchor and get up to $10,000 when you transfer your old portfolio. That's public.com/bestanchor. Paid for by Public Investing. Full disclosures in podcast description.
Best Anchor Stocks is brought to you by the Chit Chat Stocks podcast. That's right, another investing podcast you need to add to your listening rotation. My name is Brett, one of the co-hosts, and I produce 2 episodes weekly along with my co-host, Ryan Henderson. On the Chit Chat Stocks podcast, we talk stocks, a lot of stocks, from the hottest names to undiscovered gems, interviewing sector experts, studying super investors and why they are successful, and having a fun time while doing it. Follow the Chit Chat Stocks podcast on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts, and never miss an episode. That's the Chit Chat Stocks podcast on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts.
As a whole, really quickly, some other things I love about industrials, Leandro, and I think you'll appreciate this. Almost all of them, that's an exaggeration. A lot of them are incentivized based on return on invested capital or free cash flow margin or some metric that is a clear driver of free cash. So for example,
working capital.
Exactly.
Yep.
Okay. I knew you would appreciate this. Almost all of the ones in my universe are incentivized on return on invested capital or some free cash flow metric. I like mm-hmm. Number one. Number two, a lot of them have high inside ownership. A lot of them are owner-operated cultures. A lot of them are founder-led. Now, some of these are really big companies, and so if someone goes into, you know, some database and says, well, they only have 1% inside ownership, well, yeah, but the market cap may be $100 billion, you know, but the CEO may own $100 million or $200 million or $300 million, but they're still below that, like, 1% inside. But so incentivized based on return on invested capital, I'm talking, like, almost across the board, high inside ownership or high enough inside ownership, self-help initiatives, almost across the board. Because what happened was a lot of these industrials, and once again, I'm talking about industrials and infrastructure, is a lot of them overly diversified over the last 20 years, and they bought some companies they should not have bought. And so now part of the capital allocation strategy for these businesses is they're divesting the shit. They're divesting the lower margin, slower growing businesses. And so this is improving returns on invested capital because they're removing capital off the balance sheet, improving margins, which would obviously help improve returns on invested capital as well, and improving organic growth rates because they're only keeping the faster growing parts of the businesses, but also they're divesting businesses and then redeploying into some other new bolt-on acquisitions that are higher margin, faster growing, organic growing. And in some cases, they're ending up with higher recurring revenues as well. There's, you know,
the first point you discussed is so related to this. I mean, when you see a lot of compensation schemes out there, they basically are paying the CEO or the executive team to make the business larger rather than better. And a lot of industrial businesses, because they are compensated based on returns and not absolute growth or company size, they actually can make the company better and still make the full amount of their compensation, which they deserve because they are improving shareholder returns.
Absolutely. There's a great book. I think it's something like Companies That Chose to Be Great. No, yeah, Companies That Chose to Be Great Instead of Big. It's a great, I actually highly recommend it. Bo Burlingham, I think, wrote it. Eric Markowitz from Night View Capital, he writes a lot about this. Companies that, you know, put some governor on their growth to some extent when it's appropriate to do so, and choose to slow down in certain cases when it's appropriate to do so, rather than just growth at any cost. The folks at NZS Capital were the first, my really good friends at NZS Capital were the first that I found writing about this, governors on growth. Because if you can put a governor on the growth, moderate that growth somewhat, that it's easier to extend it over a longer period of time. And in that blurb that I read earlier from this Q&A that I'm going to release, I'm more interested in duration of per share growth than I am in the rate of growth today. Because rate of growth can flame out, can burn out. But if you can extend the duration of growth over the longest period possible, that's when real compounding magic can happen.
And I'd say those kinds of businesses are probably going to be heavily mispriced because of how the market views a lot of companies, that they tend to look 5 years out and then drop the value to a terminal growth rate. I mean, that's where the difference is made, when a company is growing at 8% in 10 years time or in 12 years time.
You're exactly right. And so I mentioned reason I like these at the whole. Incentivize ROIC or free cash flow, high enough inside ownership, self-help, divesting the crap, redeploying it in either returning capital to shareholders or making acquisitions that improve growth, improve margins, improve recurring revenue. That's number three. Number four is these companies are not diluted. Okay. You don't get the disease of just overly aggressive SBC to inflate free cash flow like you do in some other industries. Now, some of them are actively reducing their share count, but others are just keeping it steady. But you don't see dilution. That's number four. Number five, and this gets to your point, some of these industries are so fragmented, Leandro. And so I mentioned this in the blurb as well. You get an opportunity to grow not only organically by taking market share, but by making these bolt-on acquisitions. And if you're, a lot of companies aren't necessarily skilled at making acquisitions, but those that are, the ones that I'm looking at, the ones that I think are, at least, I could be wrong in my analysis, but the ones that I think are good at it, they could grow at 7 or 8%, Leandro, like you said, not for 10 or 15 years, for as far as I can see. I mean, obviously not forever, but for 20 years or 25 years, because the industry is so fragmented. Some of these industries have hundreds or thousands of small mom and pops. And so if you can, you know, if it's a...
And you're going to get the multiple leverage, which I think is great, right? I mean, you're going to buy a company for, let's say, 8x EBITDA and you're trading at 20. And obviously that's not an investment thesis, right? But you're getting that.
United Rentals, last week just announced it's acquiring H&E equipment. Okay. It is buying it at a higher multiple of EBITDA. It has a higher multiple of EBITDA than the company it is acquiring. It has a higher multiple of enterprise value to replacement cost, which is an important metric in the industry, than the company it is buying. It always buys companies in almost every case. It has a long history of acquisitions, growing through acquisitions, of buying companies at lower multiples than it is trading at. You know what else, though? It also grown at 6% organic growth for as far as the eye can see back into history. And so you have these businesses. United Rentals is an example where they can grow to GDP, right, 2, 3%, but they take market share. They're better than the competition. They can offer more scale. They can offer better quality products and better service. So they grow faster than GDP or faster than industry. So they take share. So if GDP or industrial production is growing at 3%, they grow maybe 4 or 5%, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they have 1% of pricing power. Now you're at 6% organic growth, 5 or 6% organic growth. And then you add one or two from acquisitions, you're at 6 or 7, maybe 8% total growth. There's a question that I see like twice a year on X, right? Which is like, why does TransDigm always trade at such a high PE? Why does CoStar always trade at such a high PE? Why does Constellation Software? And the reason is because, I think the reason is because there's no clear indication in my mind of when growth is going to slow down, because these companies are acquisition machines. They have an internal skill set and capacity to source these acquisitions, research these acquisitions, due diligence these acquisitions, value these acquisitions, and then integrate these acquisitions. They're machines in some cases.
Mm-hmm. And then you also have to add that when you look at these companies in a free cash flow basis, they're actually not trading that expensive, well, not to the same extent as the PE ratio, because they are amortizing a lot of intangibles, right? Because they are acquisitive. So obviously that's a bit misleading, right? They have cash conversion, pretty high cash conversion, above 100%.
It's exactly right. You want to add back the amortization of those intangibles in a lot of cases. You mentioned free cash flow. So here's the final fifth or sixth reason. I'll tell you why I love industrials. They're countercyclical. So they have a lot of inventory. They're selling products. Tools, components, chips, widgets, sensors, connectors. Well, when there's a downturn in the industry, they can aggressively manage that working capital. They can cut back, reduce inventory, right? And so the inventory that was a cash outflow, because you're buying that inventory, now becomes a cash inflow. A lot of these companies generate their highest free cash flow conversion, free cash flow relative to net income, and their highest free cash flow margins at the bottom of the industry.
We talked earlier about Deere, and Deere is a perfect example of this. They are basically, they took most of the inventory out of the industry now that they're going into a down cycle, and free cash flow from the peak year to the first down year is basically unchanged.
It's exactly right. And it's hard to think about that. Like, how could free cash flow be so strong, maybe even grow during an industry recession? But it happens because they can so aggressively, and they're so skilled at managing their working capital. And so then you ask yourself, what do you want from a management team? One of the things you want from a management team is management teams that are putting a crisis to good use, that are investing aggressively when either assets are on sale, so you're buying distressed assets, or when your stock is on sale, because it's an industry downturn. And when you have industry downturns, you know, all stocks fall. And so you can buy back stock at a cheap price, which, as Buffett has said, and mathematically is true, there's no greater way, there's no better way, no surer way to grow intrinsic value per share than to buy back your own stock when it's selling at a discount to intrinsic value. There's no surer way to grow intrinsic value per share. And so those are some reasons why I love industrials and infrastructure companies.
It's a bit strange, right? Because when you own a cyclical company, like an industrial that is going through a downturn, part of you wants the company to go out of the downturn. So obviously the stock price ends up going up. But at the same time, you think that the longer the company stays there, then the better for you in the future, because the company might be repurchasing stock and the upturn is going to be much more magnified by counter-cyclical action. So, and I think that's kind of an advantage, right? Because a lot of people say, okay, I'm not going to touch this company until the stock price goes up. And then there are other investors who say, okay, I want to be owner of this company first because my stake is growing without me doing anything. And secondly, because I know that this will magnify the returns of the future.
Buffett has said, when we buy a stock, the last thing we want is for the stock price to go up. Especially if you can buy greatness just at really on sale. The last thing you want is for that stock to go up, because you want management, if they're allocating capital intelligently, to have as long of a period as possible to buy back stock when it's selling at a steep discount to intrinsic value. You want, let's say the stock's at 10 times free cash flow, 10% free cash flow yield. You want that if the company's great, if it's got a growing intrinsic value, you don't want companies buying back stock if the intrinsic value is shrinking, right? Like, but if it's got a growing intrinsic value, you want them to be able to buy back stock at a 10% free cash flow yield for as long as the eye can see. So yeah, the last thing you want is for your stock to go up.
So we're going to end with two things. First, the current market environment. We are recording this the Monday after Trump launched a meme coin, the president of the United States. Then Melania Trump launched also a meme coin. The S&P 500 has had two consecutive plus 20% years. History is no good indication, actually, whether the third one is going to be good or bad, because if you look at past episodes, it's actually quite mixed. But where do you think we are in the, let's say, stock market cycle? Do you think that things are out of control? Do you think that things, even though the indices might look expensive, I don't think they are grossly overvalued, even if you look at the multiple. Do you think that this indicates that we are in for trouble, or do you think it's justified, the higher multiples due to the composition? What are your thoughts about the current market?
I don't think the market is, I think there's a lot of silliness out there. I think there's a lot of gambling going on. I think there's a lot of rank speculation taking place.
I mean, you can even bet now on interactive brokers.
You mentioned some recent meme coins. You know, there's Fart Coin, there was Hawk2a Coin. You know, there's just a lot of people flashing money around. There was a guy that bought a piece of art, which was a banana duct taped to a wall for $6 million. Just a banana from a grocery store duct taped to a wall. There's a lot of silliness going on. As far as the market, the S&P 500, if you look at the traditional ratios, valuation metrics used to value it, they're in like the 97th percentile on average, which is obviously high. But to your point, I think, you know, some of the higher PE is justified. As far as where we are in the cycle of the stock market, it's hard for me to say, because on the one hand, I think valuations are elevated, not grossly so, but I think valuations are elevated. On the other hand, we have a new administration starting today in the US. And some of the policies seem to be very pro-business, pro-corporation, pro-corporate America. You know, whether it's I think the most powerful, I think, is going to be, you know, reduced regulation. That's one. You know, reduced regulation unleashes animal spirits, and we're seeing the animals are out. Okay, the animals are out. We're
even with regulation.
Yeah, but because they know what's coming, they know what's coming. Mm-hmm. So the animals that have escaped the zoo. They're playing. They're tumbling. They're rolling around. They're, you know, starting a ruckus. So we're going to see greater animal spirits. And then the potential for lower corporate tax rates would be a boost to earnings. All else equal, I say all else equal because the S&P 500 is so concentrated in the mega cap tech companies, and those tech companies are spending so much CapEx right now. And John Huber has written about this. CapEx is like 3 times depreciation right now, which, as you know, depreciation eventually has to catch up to CapEx. And so that means we're going to see a tripling of depreciation in the next 5 years because these data centers are really depreciated over like 5 years. They're extending this, so it's not as big of a hit to earnings. They're extending it to like 6 or 7 years, but 5 year depreciation. So we could see a tripling of depreciation on the income statements of these big companies that are dominating the index right now in the next 5 years. And depreciation, all else equal, would lead to lower earnings. I say all else equal because it's possible that all of that CapEx spend leads to so much revenue growth
that it compensates.
That the revenue growth more than makes up for the higher depreciation expense, and so margins don't shrink. That's very possible.
That's probably the key question that everyone
is at. I think that is the key question, Leandro. So you could see, because the index is so concentrated in these companies, you could see earnings and returns on invested capital or margins and returns on invested capital decline. And remember, ROIC, as you know, is a driver of earnings growth. And John Huber talked about this in the article as well. You know, there's that formula, it's basic, where earnings growth, operating earnings, EBIT, is equal to the return on invested capital multiplied by the reinvestment rate. Assuming you take in no outside capital, no debt capital, you know, you don't issue any additional equity, then earnings growth cannot grow faster than ROIC. You'd have to reinvest every penny. If ROIC is 20%, earnings growth cannot be higher than 20%. And so ROIC is a driver of earnings growth. And so if depreciation goes up, ROIC goes down, you could see a scenario where earnings growth slows. That's why I said all else equal. But yeah, you know, I think the new administration could extend this rally in the stock market. If we get good GDP growth, that's definitely going to help. That drives earnings. If they can cut the debt, because the debt is an overhang, the deficit is an overhang. Mm-hmm. If they can find a way to cut that. So I really don't know where we are in the stock market cycle. The last thing I'll say about that is I look at all those metrics of the S&P and the market as a whole, and I pay attention to the silliness and the sentiment out there and the gambling that's going on, investor psychology. The main thing I focus on is how I think the companies in my coverage universe are valued. That's my main indicator. And, you know, I'm launching a portfolio, you know, very soon. I'm finding opportunities. I'm very excited about the long-term potential of this portfolio. I don't think I'm finding many back up the trucks today. And that's why I'm launching with 30% cash really quickly. You know, and I hope to deploy that cash quickly. I hope I get opportunities to deploy it quickly. I'm not launching with 30% cash because cash is paying 4 or 4.5% right now. That's nice, but that's not why. I'm launching with 30% cash because it's a residual of my selection process and how selective I am. And I'm not going to compromise on quality of the business. Mm-hmm. And, you know, valuations are, I think, on the high side of fair, the way that I look at things. And so I don't see a whole lot of screaming buys. So cash is a residual. And so I'm going to launch with 30% cash. And that cash will be a luxury if we get a sell-off, hopefully, you know, sooner rather than later, because I want to deploy it for my investors. Because that way, I won't have to sell a stock that I love to fund purchases of more stocks that I love that would be on sale. I won't have to sell a stock that I love at a temporarily depressed price, because, you know, if you assume the market crashes, pretty much everything will fall to some degree. I won't have to sell stocks that I love at temporarily depressed prices to buy something else that I love. Rather, I'm just going to have this war chest of 30% cash. And so the cash is a residual of what I'm finding right now. And I think that gives you some indication of the opportunities. You know, I'm finding some opportunities, but I cannot populate a whole portfolio right now with the quality of the businesses and the margin of safeties that I want. I just can't. And so I'm launching with cash.
Makes sense. So John, thank you very much for coming to the show. I think it was a great conversation. Actually, it kind of accelerated in a good way at the end here, talking about industrials and the qualities that these businesses have. I think a lot of people will find value in that. So thank you very much for coming, and it's been great talking to you.
Leandro, it took too long to make this happen, and I know that was on my end. I apologize. Let's do it again. You know, I love talking with you on and off camera, so I'm happy to do it anytime. You're doing great work. Your deep dives are some of the best I've come across anywhere. So thank you for having me.
Thank you very much, John. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.